So July 17th, 2023 in Spain, and we're doing the overview of the 9 principles of career dharma. All right. So again, if you would like to get a book, if you'd like to get notification of our in-depth online courses, please sign up there. Mahalakshmi, would you also check the hallway for the windows open and stuff? Yes. Or you can just get this QR code. No, we want air, though.
Yes, but...
Yeah. I'm mostly concerned about the lights in the hallway, but okay. All right. Okay? Or you can just... Okay, so I'd like you to imagine that your daily life has gradually come to include all the pastimes and activities you've always dreamed of. You love what you're doing, what you're producing, and how you're making a meaningful contribution. And your work is giving you the kinds of prosperity that truly enrich you and that you joyfully share with others. So there's more expansive parts of career dharma. The first is identifying our ideal career type and prosperity field, then learning the secrets of making our life deeply meaningful, going beyond that to progress to dharmic mastery, and then looking at the whole system for peace and prosperity. And these are our 9 principles. Connecting our nature with our livelihood, which is mostly what we've talked about the last few days. Advancing through life while nourishing our nature. That was our 3rd class. Extending our prosperity to others. Doing ethical and meaningful work of value. Having delight in cherishing our prosperity and field of work. We talked about this as one of the main problems in modern society. Having celebrations of the sacred in our life and work, being above the shades of ego, and the last 2 system ones, maintaining societal balance, cooperation between the fields, and competition within the fields, and all-inclusive, sustainable prosperity. And I'm really happy about this in English, that we were able to take these 9 principles and the 4 areas and put them together into an acronym that spells career dharma. Right, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on what we went through in our in-depth classes. So I'm going to race through those, and if you missed those classes, oh well, too bad. I'm sorry, you can watch it online or something. But as far as what we did in-depth, I'm going to go through extremely quickly. I'm going to spend more time on the areas of career dharma that we haven't covered. But even then, I'm going to be really going quite quickly. This is just an overview. So if you feel I'm not covering things in enough depth, you're right. I'm really just looking at the most basic surface things.
When are you going to give a full presentation?
Please sign up on our mailing list if you would like information about when we will have our in-depth course. I hope to work on that in Radhadesh. That will probably be an online, paid, at least 6-week course. That's not something I can do in person like this. It's too long. Even what we've done here so far is much longer than I've done anyplace else. So, like, what I've taught here, spending 2 hours or more than 2 hours, in other places I've only spent 45 minutes. Most places don't have this amount of time. So if I went through all of these in depth, even the course is never going to cover everything that's in the book. So even if we have a 6-week course, there's still going to be a lot of things that are only in the book. Of course, you can do things in a course that you can't do in a book, like answer questions and have discussions, so each have their... It's good to have the window open a little bit so we get some air. So each have their place. And when will it be done? I don't know. All right. So identifying my prosperity type and career field. So principle one, connecting our nature with our livelihood. And remember we asked this question about people who have a lot of cash but a poor life. And everyone says they know people like that. And everyone said they know people who have very little cash and a rich life. And we talked about the six ways of being rich, the six types of prosperity. Aishwarya, Gyan, Virya, Shri, Yasha, and Vairagya. And having a career that gives us the kind of prosperity that is meaningful to us. And we talked about how most people have, how many types of prosperity would you say most people have that are really important? Two or three. Usually most people have two or three that are very important to them. And there are people for whom different types of prosperity are things they don't like. No? Okay. Then we talked about the four fields. And we defined the four fields. The fields of artistry, resources, ideas, and government. We had a whole class about defining the fields. What are the fields? And that, what's the essential thing that's different about each field? The values. Oh, very clever. Thank you. That was perfect. The values are different. The Dharma is different. And these four fields always exist in human society. Individual jobs may come and go or be more or less available, but these four fields always exist in society. And how many fields can you be in? One. You can be in one field assisting another field, but you cannot be in two fields because the Dharma is different. So you can be in artistry helping in government, or you can be in ideas teaching people in government or teaching people in business. You can be in government regulating resources. We talked about the field of artistry. What's the main question that people have in this field about their work? And supportive. Is it beautiful and is it supportive? And these people provide all of the functionality of society. All of the functionality of society. All right, then we, and in talking about the field of ideas, what's the main question they have about their work? Is it truth? Is it true and is it wise? And that these people can communicate truth and wisdom through their words, through mathematics, and sometimes through the fine arts. And that although these are, that although all of the intellectuals are in this field, many people in this field are not intellectuals, and there are intelligent people in all four fields. And not all these people are teachers. Some of these people are priests, some of them are researchers, some of them are doctors, counselors. All right, talking at the field of resources, what are the main questions these people have about their work? Is it and regenerative? Sustainable and regenerative. Can it regenerate itself? Can it regenerate itself in a sustainable way? Okay, and this is the only field that produces resources for society. The people in artistry, they change the resources and work with them, and in government they redistribute them. And in ideas, they think about them. But this is the only field that actually produces resources for society. And these people have an expansive mood. Okay, and then we have the field of government. What's the main questions they ask about their work? Is it just and is it honorable? These are the people who provide for all the care in society, all the laws, the justice, the morals, the ethics. And this is not just political governments. It can be, ironically, what we call NGOs, or non-government organizations, that do the work of government, like the United Nations, like the Red Cross, or many different nonprofit organizations that do government-type work, although they're not political governments. And this also applies... Can you see the screen for me? Can you see the screen?
Yes, from there it was a little freezing.
Little freezing, okay.
Here I can see.
Okay, good. Okay, so this can also apply to a very small government, like you own an apartment building, and that's your government, that you make sure people have what they need. And people in this field, they provide for defense and protection, but they also provide for care. Okay, everybody remembers this. We spent the last 3 days going over this, and we talked about also, here we're just looking at a personal level. Don't go in someone else's field. Right? Don't go in someone else's field. Then you have to pretend that you're something that you're not, and your work becomes a vehicle of fear. And I should have put that other slide here, but I didn't. I'll do that later today for the next group. So what are the three ways in which this affects us personally when we go into the wrong field? What? Whether our mind is our friend or our enemy. If we go into the wrong field, our mind becomes our enemy. If we're in the right field, it's easy for our mind to be our friend. Yes, whether or not we're energized. When we're in the wrong field, we feel depleted. When we're in our own field, we feel energized. And the last one? Easy to offer to Krishna, detached work. When we're in the wrong field, we get very attached to the fruits of the work, the externals of the work. When we're in the right field, we're just being ourselves, and it's very easy to be detached and offer everything to Krishna. Okay, the next principle, advancing through life while nourishing our nature. So we discussed this in our second class, the difference between the dharmic expert and the initial proclivity for a field. How do you tell what field you're in before you're expert, before you're trained, before you have the dharmic expertise? We talked about how the Shastra only describes the dharmic expertise of the field, but that we also want to look for the beginning signs. And where Krishna says that we cannot repress our nature. We actually are incapable of pretending to be something that we're not long-term. And what should happen is that our teachers, our parents, and other people should help us identify our initial propensity. And the research shows that we have our initial propensity at least by the time we're 13. That's what the empirical research shows, is that people's basic values and dharma can be measured when they're 13. I've seen in my practical life that many times it's before that. That many times you can tell before someone's 13. Now, of course, in modern society, this doesn't happen so much. People tend to get very similar education and training until they're like 20. Right? It's only your third year of college that they start asking, what's your major? So this is a problem. We also talked about that one way you can tell your inclination is what you get in trouble for. What people have, this isn't always true, but it's often the case. That the things, because our nature can't be repressed, it's what we do just automatically in our lives. But if we do it in an undharmic way, it may actually cause a disturbance. So one way we can tell is to ask other people, like, what do I do a lot that's annoying? I mean, you've got to be willing to hear the answer, of course. But that can give you a real clue. And that's often important because the things that other people have told us that are annoying, we tend not to see as strengths in ourselves. And so if someone says, what's your strength? We won't find that thing. We won't notice it. We'll think that it's a problem. And I gave a number of examples of people who were criticized as children for things that ended up being their strengths. Yeah? Okay. Now, one thing we did not talk about is the relationship of career dharma to ashram dharma. And we have just one chapter in the book about this. And this is the relationship of our career to our natural life cycle. So when we're young, we should be receiving training in our specific career. Prabhupada says this in the second canto. He says that brahmachari ashram is for being trained in values of life along with specific training for a career. I personally have not seen any brahmachari ashrams in our Hare Krishna movement that do this. But that's actually what's supposed to happen. And the idea is that by the time you're finished, you are ready for your career. Again, we tend not to do this in society. If you go to college or university, we tend not to even think about this until you're in your starting your third year of college. Right? So pretty much everyone gets the same education in primary and secondary and high school. And then the first 1 or 2 years of college, you just have the general courses. And then they say, what do you want to major in, right? By that time, you're already like 19, 20 years old. What? And confused, yes. Well, it also, this has produced a mentality among a lot of young people that this is not something they need to think about when they're young. That I'm just going to think about playing games and having fun, and I won't think about what are my propensities and what are my talents. But there's several problems with this. One is that our nature manifests, it can't be repressed. So it will manifest very strongly when you're a teenager, but you're not being trained in it. You're not using it. You don't know what to do with it. And this problem may cause a lot of rebellion and difficulty. And also, I see this problem causes a lot of teenagers to try to prove that they're an adult in ways that are not helpful. You know, things like alcohol, tobacco, sex, those are for adults. So they're like, okay, well, I have to do all those now to show I'm an adult because they don't have the positive ways of being an adult. I also see that a lot of video games take this energy and pervert it, particularly video games, because in video games you become the master of an imaginary world and imaginary skills. And so this strong drive in the teenager that I want to master some craft, it's like a huge drive that starts at about 12, 13, 14. I want to master something that these people just siphon off that energy and put it into something that is 98% useless. People will say, well, I'm getting good hand-eye coordination or something. I mean, I have no problem with people doing things for recreation, but you'll have, you know, 10, 12, 15 hours that people will spend in these kind of things because we don't have a system where people's nature is being recognized and being trained at a young age. So in an ideal society, by the time you're 18, 20 years old, you actually have training in your career and you can be independent. And this is the time of life that you're actually going to work in a career. Now, it's very fascinating to me. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in one of his songs, he says, I wanted to earn money, therefore I got married. And we think of it the other way. I have a wife, I have a husband, so I have to earn money. But the Vedic idea is that people don't just have a career as a single person keeping everything for themselves. That if you want to have a career, that puts you in the grihastha ashram. And people who don't want to have any career should go on to the vanaprastha ashram. And this concept of this, you know, single life with a career, which tends to be an irresponsible life, yes? Not for everybody, but there's a tendency. So that was unknown. So that's the main time that you work in your career. Prabhupada would say, like, starting at 15 or 20 until you're 50. I mean, approximately, some people will work in their career till they're 65 or 70. But then when you come to the middle portion of life, You retire from your career. In every society, we have retirement, which means you retire from your career. And that's a time people like to travel. The traditional vanaprastha life is travel. And you can help others and guide others in their career, but you're not yourself deep in the working world anymore. And then there's very old age, where one is preparing for the final journey. And this particular cycle very much relates to questions people have about the work in my career and work in bhakti. So all of us have ashram desires, varna desires, and bhakti desires, and all three should be there for a balanced human being. But the idea is that after the prime of life, your desires to make money, your desires to influence the world, to interact in the world, have been satisfied. And you get to middle age and you say, oh, you know, I've raised good children, I've contributed to good population, I've created honest wealth, contributed to the prosperity of society, I've made my mark in the world, and now I am satisfied. And my ashram work and my career work when I'm in the middle of life has been bhakti-ized, which we'll get to a little later. But then when I retire, I say, you know, I'm ready to just now do the 64 limbs of bhakti, and I don't need to work in the world anymore because that's been satisfied. Usually if people try to do that when they're 20 or 25, then they end up falling on their face by the time they're 35 or 40. And they say, oops, I want to do all these other things. And then they can't properly go through this cycle. Perhaps I should mention just very briefly, we have a whole section in the chapter on this in our book about women and varna. So women also have fields of work. I think it should be extremely obvious to all of the females in this room that you also fit into one of the four fields. Yes? So there are some people who say that women don't have any field of work. I wonder if they've ever met a woman in their life. And it's like they think that we only have bhakti and ashram duties and we don't have any duties in the four fields. One thing is in the Shastra, especially in the Bhagavatam, there's a lot of discussion of what field a woman is in. Usually it's in relation to marriage. So that men and women are advised to marry if they're in the same general field of work. So why is that? Well, first of all, they will share the same values. That makes things a lot easier. The other thing is that traditionally, the husband and wife would work together in the same career. They were running a school together. They were managing the government together. Prabhupada said, you know, the wife is spinning, the husband is weaving, together they make a cloth. This is ideal family life. Or he said, the husband, wife, children, they're all making pots. They're all making clay pots and they sell them together. We have, of course, Krishna's most beloved devotees are the?
Gopis.
Gopis. What does that mean in English? What is gopis?
Cowherd
girls. And I find it very interesting that people say women have no field of work when we talk about the cowherd girls. I just wonder, are we reading the same books? So we know there's these pastimes where the cowherd girls, the young girls, they're going across the Yamuna. What are they crossing the Yamuna for? What do they want to cross it for? To sell their milk products. How interesting. They're businesswomen. That's what they are. They want to cross the Yamuna to sell. And they're young girls. They're teenagers. Yes, they usually go in groups. But they're crossing the Yamuna to sell their milk products. Of course, then they run into Krishna, who causes them a lot of trouble. And people will say, oh, Urmila, that's Leela. And I said, but this was the social system at the time. I said, everybody was fine with these young women going out to cross the Yamuna to sell their milk products because that was what was socially acceptable and they were part, they were just as much a part of the field of resources as the men were. Yeah, so we have Draupadi in the Mahabharata, and she's talking to Satyabhama, and she says, I am the only one who knows how much money is being collected in the kingdom and how much money is being spent. I am managing the treasury. So what would we call a person who does that?
Accountant?
Absolutely not.
The
treasurer. What? What would we call them? The secretary of the treasury. Accountant is in what field?
Artistry.
Believe me, Draupadi is not in artistry. Draupadi's in what field?
Government.
She's the secretary of the treasury. Is that a big government post? Yeah, it sure is. And then she says, I manage the royal household of 100,000 people. That's a little city, right? She's like the mayor of a town. So she's the secretary of the treasury. She's the mayor of a town. Yeah, so these are our examples. We have so many in the Shastra, of course. Yes? And then I have whole classes I give on this, so I'm not going to go into this in that much depth, but just very, 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 very briefly. Have you wondered why Srila Prabhupada, in talking about Varnashram, often talks about living in the country and having farms? So before the Industrial Revolution, both men and women generally did their career from their home. Chanakya Pandit said, a man is happy if he doesn't have to leave home to go to work. If you ran a school, the school was in your home. If you ran the government, even today, the people live in the building, the government building. Yes? You had a business out of your home. You had a craft in your home. And so the men, the women, the children were all working for their career. And the children were being trained, often from a very, very young age. Yes? Right? Then what happened with industrialization? Does anyone remember the first thing to be industrialized, or one of the first things? Huh?
Transport
was an early one. But trains was an early one. But huh?
Grains.
Before grains. Cloth. It was cloth. Yeah, the spinning and the weaving became industrialized. And that was one of was a big thing that was done at home. And so you couldn't compete with the factories. Remember we talked about what happens when resources people go into artistry? They mechanize everything, they make it factories, because they want to, they're looking at quantity and profit instead of quality. And so all of a sudden, the people making the quality textiles, they couldn't compete with the quantity factories. And so people who were making textiles at home had to all of a sudden go to a factory to work. And this became more and more like with everything. It started to be like that with pottery. And so pretty soon, the men were going to work, so they couldn't help around the house. The women were going to work. The children were going to work. You all learned this in history. The children were working in the factories. Because it used to be everybody contributed at home. Now, the problem was that the children were getting paid one half for the same work. They were also in danger, but that was mostly an excuse for this. The real reason that all these compulsory education laws were passed was that the children were taking jobs away from the adults. Because they were being paid at half price. So all of a sudden they said, okay, all the children have to go to school. Then people also moved to where there were factories, which broke up the families, broke up the villages. We went from 98% of people living in villages to 90% of people living in cities. You lost the extended family. One way women had career was that there was an extended family. So it wasn't that one woman had to do all the cooking, all the cleaning, all of this, all of that. She had her mother-in-law and her sister-in-law and all these other people. And then we, by all these machines, we lost the servant class. We have a dishwashing machine and a clothes washing machine and a floor cleaning machine. But your servants didn't just wash the dishes, they also helped with the children, and they also helped with everything. So we lost extended family, we lost the servant class. We lost the ability to work from home. But there was not birth control and abortion, so women were still having a lot of children. So if you're having an average of 6 children, and you've lost your extended family, and you lost your servants, are you going to be able to work? No. You're not going to be able to work. So you're going to lose your whole career dharma. All you're going to have left is your ashram. All right, now I want you to think about this. I've asked this question of many people. So you have a nature. You have a nature to work in the field of resources. You have a nature to work in artistry. Or you have a nature to work in government. But you can't do it now. How are you going to feel?
Frustrated.
And anyone who says that women only have ashram duties are saying that the Supreme Lord desires half of the human population to live lives of? Of? What?
Misery.
Misery, frustration. Is that a nice God?
No.
You want to go hang out with him forever? I don't think so. So you have this chunk of time. Women were marrying young, having a lot of children. They lost their extended family. They lost their servants. And they couldn't work from home anymore. Because if they worked from home, they couldn't compete with the factories. So they lost a huge chunk of their lives and they were frustrated. At least they were still busy because they had a lot of children and the home wasn't completely mechanized. Then you get to the introduction of widespread birth control. All of a sudden women are only having 2.5 children. And the children are going away to school because there's compulsory education. And the home is becoming more and more and more industrialized. So now women are not only frustrated, but they are also bored. They're bored. They're bored. And so what happened in the 60s and 70s? The women said, we're tired of choosing ashram over varna. We're going to choose... We're going to choose varna instead of ashram. We're not going to marry. We're not going to have children. We're not going to take care of the family. We're going to just get a career. And the result of that is chaos. Family's been destroyed. The whole foundation of society has been destroyed. So people think, well, the solution is to go back to 1950 and to have women be bored and frustrated. Does that sound like a very good solution? Let's go back to 1950 where women were frustrated because they lost their career dharma and bored because they didn't have enough to do in their ashram dharma. And they became, you know, domestic workers with sex, basically. Does that sound attractive to anybody? So this is why I see Srila Prabhupada is saying to go back to simple living, because when you have simple living, then you have a way for everybody to do ashram, varna, and bhakti. Men, women, and children. Now, we probably will not go back to 1800. I see some devotees trying to go back to 1800. I've never seen any group of people do it successfully for 10 or 15 years. I've seen people do it somewhat successfully for maybe 5 years. They're usually not doing it completely.
They're, what about 100?
I don't want to talk about specific examples. That's a really bad idea. But I haven't seen anybody doing it completely, ever. I see that even when people say we're going back to 1800, they're using something from modern society. They're still using some cars, or they're using the internet, or they're buying their cloth, or something. And even people who say they're doing it all the time, I see that after 5 or 10 years, they stop. They want a washing machine. Yeah? Right? And one thing that's very encouraging to Rukmini and I is that the information revolution and actually even the pandemic really opened up a door to people working from home again. Yeah? To bringing back home crafts and home occupations. And so what, instead of us thinking, let's go back to 1800, which has not proved to be successful anywhere that I'm aware of, and I'm aware of most attempts in the Hare Krishna world, instead, why don't we look forward? And how can we take the principles of ashram dharma, the principles of career dharma, and the basic practice of bhakti, and apply that in the modern world so that everybody has what they're going to need for what Prabhupada called our psychophysical nature, and that everybody is nicely engaged, and that no one is either bored or frustrated. All right. So now we finished the first area of linking our prosperity type and career field to our work. And now we looked at the second, and in that was the linking of that and the nourishing according to our life cycle. So now we're moving out a little bit, because even if you did everything we just talked about, that still isn't enough. So we're going to expand to find satisfaction and purpose in our work. So principle 3, we hadn't discussed at all, and that is extending our prosperity to others. So Srila Prabhupada told my god sister Yamuna, if you don't teach other people how to cook, you will become envious. Envy is, I want more than you. You know, you can have a nice car, but I want mine to be a little better. Right? And the opposite of that is sharing. It's very interesting that the Sanskrit word for a kind of wealth is bhaga, which comes from the root word bhaj, which means to divide or share. And this is why I understand that Bhaktivinoda said, I wanted to earn money, therefore I needed to marry. If we're earning wealth, we need to share it with somebody. At least a family member. Somebody. This idea that I should keep all the money for myself and all the prosperity for myself. I mean, I've met a lot of people who said, we don't want children because we want to keep all the money for ourselves. And I'm like, that's not a good reason to not have children. You know, I don't want to marry because I don't want to have to share any of my prosperity with anyone else. Huh? I mean, the Vedic idea is that you're supposed to share even with the creatures around your house. Now, of course, this means cash. But it also means any of our type of prosperity. Now, I should mention that some people think that giving to Krishna is charity. It's not. It's not. It's only giving to Krishna, only time that giving to Krishna is charity is when you don't know it's Krishna. So what's an example of that? We did yesterday morning. Who gave to Krishna without knowing it was Krishna? Bali Maharaj. So when Bali gave to Vamandev, he wasn't sure, he thought it might be Krishna. That's charity. Otherwise, giving to Krishna is yajna. So if I offer food to Krishna, then I'm not giving in charity. That's yajna. And if I give you all the prasadam, that's charity. Clear? Yes? And Krishna says in the 18th chapter that even great souls should give in charity. So I can also give in charity from the different types of prosperity that I'm getting from my work. If I'm getting leadership, if I'm getting beauty, if I'm getting renunciation, I should share that with other people. I can use my leadership abilities as a volunteer. And I think this is where we run into the question people ask about my engagement in bhakti without being paid. So I have a job where I'm gaining beauty in my work and I'm getting paid. It's my livelihood. And then I can volunteer my time at the temple to use that beauty I've gained in my work as a volunteer. I'm gaining knowledge in my work for which I'm getting paid. then I can volunteer and use that knowledge and give it to others. Now, obviously not just to the temple. I can give that in many ways to many people who are less fortunate. But here we have this indication that the same kind of things I use in my livelihood, I should also be using as a volunteer. And that way I'm sharing my prosperity. Okay, principle four. Yeah? By the way, this is a teeny, teeny, tiny bit of what we discuss in the book. So we go, this is, I just picked one or two things. And in the book we go into much greater depth and we give examples of people who share their prosperity types with others. And I'm sure there's many other ideas and inspirations you could have about how to share the type of richness that you enjoy. What's also nice about this way of looking at things is that if you don't have a lot of cash, you can still give in charity. You know, if you're just earning enough cash to pay your rent and buy your food and put, you know, petrol in your car, and you really don't have much left over, even for luxuries for yourself, what to speak of giving, you can always give from these prosperity types. Can you share your knowledge? Can you share your leadership skills? Can you share your strength? Can you share your health? Can you use your fame in volunteer work? You know, all of these are all also types of prosperity. They're real prosperity, aren't they? They're just as real as cash. I mean, psychologically, I think they're more real than cash. And they're just as valuable to share with others. Okay, principle four, ethical and meaningful work of value. So we could be in the right place. We could have been mentored by the right person. We could be sharing, and we still wouldn't be fully dharmic if we're doing work that's dishonest. Yeah? Right? Like those mafioso people. Right? They might be in the right place. They're doing government-type work, and they might even be giving in charity, and they might have been trained by their family. They've gotten everything up to here. So work should be honest. So what do we mean by honest? Well, we should be charging a fair price for the goods and services that we're providing. We should be representing our goods and services honestly, representing our qualifications honestly. We should be paying the people who work for us honestly, paying our vendors honestly, paying people a fair price. One of the problems I see among devotees is this idea that only unpaid work is service. And then, like, if they have to pay somebody, they pay them as little as possible. That's not honest, is it? I mean, sometimes you have people who say, look, you know, I'd like to volunteer, but I can't do that, but I'm willing to take a very low price. That's different. But in general, if I'm hiring a plumber, whether that person is a devotee or not, I should pay them the fair price that I pay a plumber and not say to them, you know, well, you're a devotee, you should do this as a service. And this is not just what you pay of people, what you expect of people, how many hours they put in. Yeah? All right, so that's honest work. And then the next thing, that's not enough. You could be an honest tobacco salesperson. Our work should also be of value. We should be doing work that makes a genuine contribution to people's lives. Nowadays, a lot of work is what I'd call manufactured needs. It's things we don't need. You know, toys your kids don't need that you just throw away. New fashions every 2 months that, you know, again, they're just thrown away. They become a big recycling problem for the world. All kinds of things that nobody needs, you know, a banana slicer, an automatic banana slicer, you know, all these things. So we should be doing things that have real value and certainly things that are not harmful. So not selling, you know, tobacco, alcohol, pornography, not things that are actually hurting people. Now, I would say that in 2023, it's probably impossible to do these two things absolutely. There's probably somebody somewhere in the supply chain of things we're using that is getting hurt. I mean, I'm using a phone and a computer, and for the rechargeable lithium batteries, there are children in slave labor in African mines. And I'm still using phones and computers. You know, and it's one of these very difficult things in 2023 that all of us are implicated to some extent in harm. You know, even if you think, well, I'm going to live in the forest and I'm not going to take anything from modern society, you know, how many people can live like that? But we shouldn't use that as an excuse. Well, I can't be 100% free of harm and 100% honest, and therefore I shouldn't bother at all. But our work should really be honest and producing things of value. So yeah, I'll tell you this one story about myself. So for many years, I was using illegal software. I was very poor, and I figured I couldn't afford legal software, and what could I do? And then I was having a discussion with some devotees. This was at Bhaktivedanta Manor. 3 or 4 devotees about integrity and honesty. And we were talking like maybe for an hour, and then all of a sudden I thought, I need to start using legal software. I need to stop using pirated software. So this was November, and I said to everyone there, I said, by January of the next year, so I gave myself 14 months. I said, not by this next January, but by the next January, in 14 months, I will have all my software be legal. So Krishna must have been extremely happy with my saying that, because 3 days later, somebody comes up and says, or a different person, someone who was not in that discussion and who did not know about that discussion, came up to me and said, Urmila, I'd like to give you this donation for you to buy software. Isn't that nice? Krishna's so far out. I really like him. So after that, he's really cool. So after that, I've had only legal software. So this being honest, it's subtle, right? I was making so many excuses for my dishonesty. And I've also found that I can get discounts for educators and things like that. So I have a lot of good quality software that I buy legitimately as a teacher. It's all worked out well. But whatever kind of work we're doing, we should be honest and doing work of real value. And I know sometimes it's hard. And I know sometimes we think, like I thought, I can't afford it. I can't afford to have honest work of value. But I'm convinced at this point that we can. And if this is a real problem for people, I say take baby steps. I was teaching this in Italy, and there were a lot of people from the general public, and one man in the front, when I was teaching this, started sobbing. Looked like he was in his 40s, maybe, and he was just sobbing. And he said, you know, my family business is a restaurant, and we're serving meat. And you were there then?
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do. And I said, baby steps, baby steps. What can you do? Because the poor man was in so much anxiety. I said, you know, at least move in that direction. I feel so bad. This guy was like, so at least move in that direction and have some faith. There's a nice story in the Chaitanya Charitamrita about Magrari the hunter. Any of you familiar with that story? So Magrari made his living selling animal fur and leather, and he would kill the animals himself. But he would kill them in a way that they would die very slowly. He would intentionally give them a slow, painful death. And so Narada Muni was walking through the forest, and he saw these animals like that. And as he was walking, the animals got afraid and ran away. And Magrari said, "Who's scaring my animals?" And Narada said, "I am." And he said, "Look, you know, what you're doing is very sinful." He said, you know, he showed Magrari this vision of how these animals would come in his next life and torture him. And McGrory said, well, this is how I know to earn my living. I don't know any other way to earn a living. And Narda says, well, okay, you can keep killing animals, but kill them quickly and completely. Don't give them a slow, painful death. And McGrory said, you know, I think I want to stop this, but I don't know what to do. I don't know how else to live. And Narada Muni said, I'll tell you another way to live, but first you have to...
Throw the bow.
He said, you have to first throw away your bow. So this is often the way it works, that we have to take a leap of faith. Narada gave him another way of living, and he came back to check on him, how are you doing? And McGrory says, you're sending too much food. My wife and I can't even eat all of it. So sometimes before we have the answer to another way of living, we have to be willing to give up something that's dishonest or harmful. And Prabhupada has an interesting comment in the purport there. He said, our income is supplied by God, and what we do to make a living is simply a matter of our choice. He said, if you want to live by hunting, you'll get your income by hunting. If you want to live as a brahmana, you'll get your income as a brahmana. He said, their income is supplied by God. So this thinking that if I do something that's honest and I do something that's of value, I won't make as much money, is not true. What we're going to get, we're going to get. By the way, how much money we get depends karmically on how charitable we are. The main source of our cash income is how much charity we gave in other lives and how much charity we give in this life. Doesn't that make sense? If you had 6 children and you gave a plate of cookies to the first one and that child ate all of the cookies, you wouldn't give them a whole plate of cookies next time, would you? You'd only give them one. But if you give a whole plate to the first child and the first child shares with their brothers and sisters, then you're going to give them more next time. So if Krishna sees that we share our wealth with those who are less fortunate, he gives us more. And if he sees that we're selfish, he gives us less. So it's not that we're going to get more or less. Now you might say, well, Urmila, some people do change jobs and make more money. Sometimes they make more money, but they also spend more money. Even with cash, it's not just how much you're bringing in. I had a good friend who was making a lot of cash every month, and he was always cash poor. It was so funny. Why? You know, Krishna kept giving him these huge expenses that he had to pay for. So how much cash you have is not just what's on your, you know, payroll. And these things, we can't really change them by doing something sinful. If I do something sinful and I do something dishonest, I'll make more cash. It actually doesn't work that way. Then, of course, if we do something dishonest or harmful, we're going to be even poorer in the next time around. Yeah? All right. Now, there's another way to do work of value. We have a whole chapter on this, way beyond what I already talked about. Because what I already talked about is within the law of karma. And when we were first working on career dharma, and I gave a class like on this, just this topic, in the Denver Sunday Feast, and it was one of my most favorite classes, but I don't have time to give a whole hour on this. All right. So, the law of karma is that you only get what you've earned. It's fair. It's absolutely, totally, totally fair. If I get good things, it's because I've done good things. If I get bad things, it's because I've done bad things. And all I can be is the delivery person for your karma. If you've done good karma, and I do something good for you, all I'm doing is delivering your karmic results. I cannot give you good karma that you have not earned. If I could give you good karma that you have not earned, then I could give you bad karma that you have not earned, and the whole world would not be fair, and nobody would like that. Would anybody like that?
No.
No. So when I'm doing things of value for society, and I'm doing things that are good for society, I'm just the DHL driver delivering people's good karma. Now, if I choose to deliver your good karma, I get good karma. If I choose to deliver your bad karma, I get bad karma. You follow? Make sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. All right? But I'm not changing your karma.
If you're to deliver good, bad karma, do you get the results?
No. By that I mean, like, let's say that you're destined to lose money. That's your destiny. And I steal it from you. I can't steal money that you weren't destined to lose. I can't take money from you that you weren't going to lose anyway. But if I steal your money, I get bad karma. Let's say I give you money. I can't give you money that you didn't earn through your pious activities. But if I give you money, I get good karma. So if I deliver your good karma, I get good karma. If I deliver your bad karma, I get bad karma. Did you get that?
And we can choose to do or not to do.
I can choose, yes. I can choose to do good for others or bad to others. But when I choose to do good for others, I am not actually increasing the good in their life beyond what they have earned. Okay, please listen carefully. What they have earned means they've done some austerity. Like I was saying, you get money according to how charitable you are. It's all balanced. Whatever I'm getting, I've done some difficulty to get that. I never get, nor can I give anybody, an absolute good without some payment. Are you all following the logic of this? Everybody following the logic? Karmically, whatever good I get, I have to pay for it. I have to do some austerity. I have to do something that's selfless. And I can't give you something you haven't paid for. So everything's always in balance. So it's never really getting anywhere. It's always in balance. How could I do what I want to do? What I want to do is I want to give you good that you haven't earned. I want to give you an absolute, we were talking about absolute earlier, I want to give you an absolute good that there's no payment for. I want to do that for you. And I would like that myself too. Wouldn't you all like that? Yeah? There's a part of us that doesn't like that. There's a part of us that wants to say, I earned what I have. Sometimes we resist free gifts. But in general, we want this increase of good without payment. Now, that can only happen when we get out of this, what Rukmini and I call the cycle of frustration. You do honest, valuable work according to your nature. You get prosperity. You spend it for enjoyment. Then you get frustrated. Take a vacation. Do something else. Then you get frustrated with that. And again, you do good, honest work. And this keeps going. So above this is love. To work for love. Love of your work. Love of the other people. And ultimately love for Krishna. Now what happens is, bhakti is unearned good. That's why Prabhupada calls it, what kind of mercy? Causeless. It's unearned good. And it can be ever expanding and dynamic. So if through my livelihood, I'm an agent of bhakti, then I can give people not only work that's honest and of value in an ordinary way, but I can contribute to dynamic, ever expanding, unearned good that nobody ever has to pay for. Isn't that totally cool? All right, now another aspect to doing ethical work of value is what we talked about in depth yesterday, and this is not doing other people's work because it harms society. There's two reasons not to do other people's work. One is that it hurts me. So that's really in principle one, that I should match my nature to my livelihood. But here in this principle four, that I should do honest ethical work of value, as soon as I'm in someone else's field, I'm causing harm. So I'm not going to discuss this at all now, because we discussed this in so much length, in so much depth yesterday. Sometimes I show this, sometimes this is the only presentation that I show. So I have everything here. We talked about crossing government and resources, government and ideas, ideas and resources, government and artistry, ideas in artistry, resources and artistry. And we talked about the harm that that causes to society, yes? Now, even yesterday, I didn't go into all the detail that's in the book, but I think you got a very good grasp of how much we mess up society when we are in the wrong field. All right, so now we've gone beyond making our work meaningful and purposeful, and now we're going to progress even further to dharmic mastery. So here we have three principles. Now, this first one is what I talked about when I said why there's so many problems in the world. And remember I said one is that people are in the wrong field? Yes? And another is that people are in the right field, but they're messing it up. They're not doing the dharma of the field. So that's what we're going to look at now. And we're going to look at that now both in terms of prosperity type and field of work. And I would say this is a really, really important principle of career dharma. But it's more advanced than just, I want to know who I am and where I belong. So looking at our prosperity types, all these six types of prosperity are under the jurisdiction of? Well, they can be under the jurisdiction of Maya, or? Yes, yes. Sri, Lakshmi Devi. Yes. And that's the difference. Am I going to enjoy my six types of prosperity under the shelter of Durga or under the shelter of Lakshmi Devi? Now, not cherishing our prosperity is like cutting off the head of the goose that laid the golden egg or cutting off the limb of the tree that you're sitting on. Now, the first thing we want to cherish is ourselves, our own body and mind. I've seen people work at jobs so that they destroy their health. You seen this?
Yes.
You know, too many hours, always in a dark room, not getting any exercise, no time to eat healthy food. So part of cherishing our prosperity is to cherish our physical health and our mental health. We should make sure that whatever we're doing is also cherishing our physical and mental health. And then taking care of the other people that we work with, especially if they are our subordinates. But our subordinates, our colleagues. Have any of you ever been in a work environment where people were abusing or mistreating people physically or mentally? I have. Making people work too many hours, putting them in the wrong place, just basically not taking care of them. And if they're devotees telling you that you'd be really surrendered if you accept that you're being harmed. You'll get rid of your ego, Prabhu, if we harm you physically and emotionally. You see these guys down here? Can you see this? This poor guy who's being overworked physically and this poor guy who's being overworked emotionally. Right? So cherishing our work means taking care of the people we work with. And of course it also means taking care of our environment. Making sure that we don't do work that harms the environment. Now here we look at specific ways of cherishing our type of prosperity. Making sure our goose that lays the golden eggs also gets fed. Basically. And this is just a very, very short list of a few ideas. Again, in our book, we go into this in far more depth. How, if you're enjoying virya from your work, how are you going to cherish that? Make sure that you don't use artificial chemicals that hurt you in order to be strong and healthy. Make sure your health is coming naturally. Use your strength for the good of others. Don't use it to exploit others. Make sure what you're producing is, again, of natural strength and health. Aishwarya, this is interesting. If you're getting Aishwarya from your work, help other people to feel smart and competent. Don't just domineer and control everybody. Not that, well, I'm the big leader, so you're all idiots, you know. Help other people also to feel that they have something of value. There's several books on this called Being a Multiplier. make other people in the room feel smart and competent. Okay. If you're getting knowledge from your work, make sure you keep your emotional intelligence. Right? Remember that you could be wrong, no matter how much you know and how smart you are. You could make a mistake. You might not even know how much you're wrong. And love knowledge for how much it benefits others. Right? If you're getting yasha, people who get a lot of yasha, they might say, well, I'm a big, important, famous person. So therefore, you have to respect me even when I'm doing something unethical or even when I'm wrong. Right? So if we're enjoying yasha, not to use our good reputation in order to put other people down. If we're getting shri, to make sure we have high standards of fairness and that we don't use beauty for personal advantage and to bewilder others. And if we're getting vairagya, this is interesting, if we're getting vairagya, remember, again, to keep, maybe you could just like turn it on vibrate, Mahalakshmi? You don't know how to do that? Can someone show her how to get her phone off ring, please? Here. Mahalakshmi. Just have, it's usually just, you just push the volume control and you can choose. Okay, so if we're getting vairagya, we should remember to emotionally connect with others. Right? To not be so detached that I don't care about other people. I'm enjoying my vairagya so much that the whole world can just be destroyed and I don't care. All right, let's look at the four fields. How do we cherish our fields? This is huge. It doesn't have anything to do with that. It just has to do with whether or not your phone rings.
Okay.
So this is a huge problem in modern society. People aren't keeping the integrity of their field. They're not keeping the integrity of their field. So in artistry, you have to keep high quality in your craft. Don't cheat on the materials. Don't cheat on the methods. Make sure you keep the quality. Make sure you serve your customers and clients nicely. Is this a problem often? They keep you on hold for 3 hours, right? They go, sorry, we can't do anything for you. Keeping your prices honest. I mean, you are not able to see mine the way. Is that better? Is that better? All right, if you're in government, remember your main job is to serve the people. And that you're supposed to be sacrificing your own interests for the greater good. This has become a big problem with police officers. Taking care of everyone's needs, not having special interests. Not saying, well, these people pay more in taxes. These people are more likely to vote for me. I'm going to take care of them first. Not taking from the government for your personal gain. All right, in resources, treating the plants and animals with kindness and respect. Is this a huge problem today? Yeah, it's huge. Making money by, you know, basically raping the earth. You know, and destroying the plants and having these poor animals live horrible lives of suffering and then death. Having long-term planning for the environment. Treating your employees, these people are the main employers. Treating your employees with respect. Having all financial dealings honest. And ideas, making sure that you apply truth in a way that benefits people. Always being objective. And this means being careful that somebody can't control you financially. That you don't have someone who's there paying for you, so you're going to twist the truth in order to make money. Yes? Respecting others' expertise. This has become a real problem in modern society. The lack of respect for experts. You know, people, Prabhupada gives us as the example of cheating. You actually don't know, but you present yourself as an expert. Yes. Right, these are just some ideas. Again, there are we have a whole chapter we devote to this about how the fields can be cherished and protected. Having celebrations of the sacred in our life and work, this is yajna. This is the concept of yajna. So in Bhagavad Gita 3:16, Krishna talks about evam pravaritam chakram. And Prabhupada gives a lecture on this. He says, chakra means a wheel, and a wheel means it's moving. So in nature, the plants and animals take from nature and give back to nature automatically. And Prabhupada would often say, yajna is like paying your electrical bills. You know? We're taking light from the sun, from the moon, we're taking water, we've got to give back. Again, this is different from charity. Charity I'm giving to other beings, and here I'm giving back to God. Now, however somebody understands God, or whatever tradition they have, that's not the point. The point is that we should be regularly having celebratory ceremonies of connection. At least we should stop in our day or in our week. We should have regular times where we stop and we say, I'm going to pay my electric bill to God. I'm going to give back to him. I'm going to connect with him. And it's interesting, these different ceremonies of connection are very similar across all the religions. Right? You study the scripture, usually lighting some kind of lamp is involved, saying some kind of prayers, hearing the stories of great personalities in your tradition, going to holy places, saying prayers alone or in a group. I mean, those sort of things are pretty universal as celebrations of connection. Now, ultimately, what we would like to do is have every act be a ceremony of connection. And we talked about this a little bit in terms of the difference between work and yajna, but that eventually every moment should be like this. And when every moment is like that, when everything I'm doing in my work, I'm doing for the pleasure of the divine. And that's not so difficult. I mean, what does Krishna say makes us very dear to him? He says, if you're not envious but are a kind friend to all living entities, he's very dear to me. Just treat people nicely can be done as a yajna. You can treat people nicely so you can say, well, I'm a very nice person, I treat people nicely. Or you can treat people nicely because you say, Krishna wants me to treat people nicely. I can be honest in my work as a yajna to please Krishna. I can cherish my prosperity to please Krishna. I can give charity to please Krishna. I can be in my right field to please Krishna. Do you follow what I'm saying? So it's not just a specific ceremony where I say specific prayers, whether they're in French or English or Latin or whatever they may be, or Sanskrit. It's not just that, but it's my motive. I'm doing this to give back. I'm doing this to give back. Krishna is my ability. Krishna is my intelligence. Krishna is my fire of digestion. Krishna is my resting place. Krishna is my home. The air is his breath. Everything I'm using, everything I'm enjoying, everything I am, is him or coming from him. And so everything I do, it doesn't matter what job it is. It doesn't matter whether I'm a bank teller or I'm a guitar teacher, or whether I'm administering, you know, funds for homeless people. I'm doing this to please Krishna. I'm doing this to please Krishna. I'm doing this to please Krishna. And every act becomes a ceremony. And when we do that, then we find joy in every moment of what we are doing. And when we get some good result, we find as much joy in that as we found at every moment of working. But at least we can start with, I'm going to have a certain time every day set aside for a ceremony of connection. Or at least once a week, I'm going to have a certain time set aside, I stop everything else, and I'm going to connect. Our last individual principle, is above the shades of ego. So these are our three shades. So tamas is like a dark shade, like we have this dark. That's very dark. When that's down, you can't see any light through it at all, right? Then rajas is kind of like that green one over there where the light's coming through a little bit. It could be a little more sheer, so you sort of see shapes. You see some light, you see shapes. Sattva is like the open window. And being above the shades is like being outside. So I came up with another one, and I haven't had time to make a slide for it. It's on my mental to-do list. Imagine that life is a flowing, beautiful river. In tamas, you pollute the river. You foul the river. F-O-U-L, not F-O-W-L. In rajas, you push the river. You force the river. You build dams. You put concrete at the sides. You make it go where you want it to go by force. In sattva, you plunge into the river and you flow in the river. And above the shades of ego, you play in the river and you frolic in the river. So that's a lot of fun with the English words. If you all figured out I was using all P's and all F's, that was a lot of fun coming up with that. And I do want to make some slides on this. Yes? So what are these shades of ego? They're degrees of ego and they're kinds of ego. So Thomas is like, I'm not a materialist. Yeah, I'm not working hard for all these materialistic people. Yeah, they want prestige and they want money. Yeah, I'm not like that. I'm simple, you know? Like, I'm just going to do what's easy. Look, if McDonald's sells a vegetarian burger at the same price as the meat, and I can go there, and I'll buy it, sure. If it's more expensive, I have to go to a special store, forget. You know, if it's easy, I'll do it if it's easy. Yeah, I'm a simple person. And I take care of my family, I take care of what I need, and don't you mess with them, you're going to be sorry. I get insulted very easily. I don't tolerate anything like that. So that's tamas. Then you have rajas. I'm a very good person. I'm very honest. I'm very upright. I pay all my taxes. I'm probably even very religious. You can notice me going to church every Sunday. I was in the newspaper going to church the other day. And I work very, very hard for everything I have. All these things, you see everything I have? I work for all of that, and I will tell you how I worked for all of that. I will tell you how I sacrificed and worked hard and did austerity for years to do all that. It's mine. I work for it. I have built society. I am the one who's contributed to the hospitals and the schools and the churches, the museums. And I hope my name will be in the history books. It probably will be, you know, and I'll get a statue for me in the park. And then there's sattva. I'm very spiritual. I don't run around working hard, and I'm not lazy. You know, I'm not like those people. I'm very detached. I have a shelf full of crystals and angels, and, you know, I'm very balanced and forgiving because it makes me feel so good inside. You know, I'm just kind of separate from all these people running around in the world. So, what are they all about? Me! Therefore, they're all shades of ego. Now, these shades of ego are like the dark side of our work. We have two problems with these shades of ego in our work. One is that to accomplish our work, we might be tempted to pull energy from these shades of ego. We might think, okay, I have a particular type of work to do, and that shade of ego looks like it's got the right energy. I think I'll take from it. But as soon as we do that, we become contaminated by it. Or in the process of doing our work, we may be influenced by it. And certain kinds of work tend to be influenced by certain shades. Now, for all of us, these different shades of ego are going to infect our body and mind at different times. This is what Krishna says. He says, no one is free from the influence of these throughout the material world. And Prabhupada says very clearly in his purport to 14:22-25 in the Bhagavad Gita that as long as we have a material body and mind, our material body and mind will be hit by these at different times. You know, we may be hit by sattva at one time and by tamas at another time. So what are we going to do? So Krishna talks about giving charity in the shades and above the shades. He gives many, many, many examples, but this is one that we'll look at. So in tamas, you give charity to the wrong person for the wrong reason. You give alcohol to an alcoholic. Now, or you give to the right person for the right cause, but you don't do it nicely. Here you go, Maharaj, here's your charity. You know, take it, leave me alone. Or we give it the wrong time. You know, someone's sitting on the toilet and you give them charity. So, then you have rajas. Rajas you give to the right person for the right cause, but you're giving with the wrong personal motive. You're calculating. Okay, let's see. Now, if I give to this person, I'll be rich in my next life. Right? Or if I give charity to this person, they'll feel some obligation to me. And they'll want to do something. Right? Oh my goodness, I'm just thinking of, I was at one temple, and I had two classes I was scheduled to give that day, and I got an invitation to be on a radio show. So I went to the temple president, and I said, I've gotten a radio show invitation. I would like to do that. I said, but I'll need to cancel one of my temple classes. I can't handle three classes in a day. And he says, you can't do that. I paid your airfare. Yeah. So, you know, you're thinking like that. Well, I'm going to do something for you, and then I'm going to get something. That's not really charity, is it? That's a business exchange. So if you make charity into a business exchange, or if you give and then later you regret, I'd like you to remember that charity is not just cash. Charity is any of our types of prosperity. If you're giving your strength, your health, and you regret it later, you know, oh yeah, I spent 10 years in the ashram working hard, I wish I hadn't done that. That's charity in rajas. And I see that the other kind of charity in rajas is when we try to obligate people. You know, I don't really want to give this charity, but my boss told me to give it, my guru told me to give it. We guilt trip people, manipulate people. Or we say, give charity and you'll get, you know, we'll put your plaque up on the wall. And I studied a whole book about charity many years ago, and I concluded that a lot of times when we in the Hare Krishna movement ask people to give in charity, we're doing it in rajas. We're talking about what they're going to get back, how they're going to benefit, or we're putting them under some kind of guilt trip or some kind of sense of obligation. Huh? I'm getting there. I'm getting to sattva. No, I'm just not there yet. All right, don't worry. Nice that you're so eager. All right, what about charity and sattva? Charity and sattva, I'm giving to the right person for the right cause just because it makes me happy. Right person for the right cause, right time, proper mood. I'm not trying to get something back externally. I am trying to get something back internally. Therefore, it's still a shade of ego. In Rajas, I'm trying to get something back externally. I want you to think well of me. I want you to do a favor for me next time. I want to ingratiate myself to my authority. You understand? In Sattva, I'm just thinking I want to feel happy. And if I give in charity, I'll feel happy. So I'm giving to the right person, for the right cause, at the right time, in the right mood, but I'm still wanting something for myself. I'm wanting my own internal happiness. And then above the shades of ego, I'm giving to the right person, for the right cause, at the right time, in the right mood, to make who happy?
Krishna.
So then it becomes dana and yajna. You understand? It becomes charity and yajna. Okay, let's look at the shades in work. So in tamas, disengaged, lazy, procrastinating. Prabhupada says something you could do in 1 hour, you take 4 years to do. By the way, we all tend to procrastinate if we're doing work outside our field. So you can see doing work outside our field tends to push us into tamas. Right? We become lazy. We become disengaged. Deceitful. Oh yes, I worked hard all day and you were just surfing the internet. Right? Insulting to others. Lazy. In Rajas, very attached. You work very hard if you think you're going to get something you want, and if you think you're not going to get something you want, you won't work hard. Your determination is dependent upon whether or not you think you're going to get a good result. Envious of others, I worked harder than that person, why do they have more than me? Very affected by good and bad. Something good happens, oh, something bad happens. In sattva, steady determination and enthusiasm without wavering in success or failure. I find this fascinating because I've met a lot of devotees that equate determination with rajas. They think if I'm determined, I must be using rajas. No, determination in rajas is very dependent on the result, and determination in sattva it's internal. I'm determined because I feel so good when I'm determined. Because I feel so much in balance and so happy when I'm determined. Okay, how do we do work above the shades of ego? This is an analysis of Bhagavad Gita 3.30. That in Bhagavad Gita 3.30, Krishna gives three things not to do and three things to do. So to get above the shades of ego, don't try to enjoy the six types of prosperity as a merchant. I'm earning them. Then we're under Durga. Don't think I own anything. I don't own my work. I don't own the results of my work. I don't own my talents. Mahalakshmi, can you just stop? Mahalakshmi, I'd appreciate it if you just give up and stop. Okay? You've tried, and you've tried, and you've tried, and it's a distraction. Thank you. I appreciate that you're trying. I appreciate you want to do it, but...
I like to be said, you know.
Yes, I know. I know. But it's gotten to the point that it's a distraction. So, I don't own anything, right? We had all these classes on Krishna meditation. How much... What do I own? What do I own? Nothing.
Happiness.
I own my happiness. Actually, what do I own? There's a nice purport where Prabhupada says one should know what is his and what is not his. I think it's in 1515 purport. What is ours? Our free will, our desire. That's ours. That's mine.
Also, I remember the verse, you're entitled to work. You're entitled to do the duty, but not entitled to the free will.
Yes, that's a very often quoted verse, although hardly anybody understands it. So yes, you should be yourself. You should do the work that's an expression of yourself. You have the right to be yourself, but you're not the owner. You're not the owner. Krishna is the owner. And this is also an interesting one. Let go of the lethargy born of fever. Jwara. Now, jwara or fever is odd. Let's think about when we're sick and we have a fever. We don't want to do anything. I just want to lie in bed. I'm sick. So this is really heavy tummus. You know, oh, I can't do anything. I don't want to do anything. Everything's too hard. But there is sometimes, at least the English word fever has the opposite meaning. And sometimes when people are sick, they're feverish, running around. Yeah? Feverish action. But it's not directed. It's not intelligent. So to not be lazy and also just to not be crazy busy, you know? Like Prabhupada talked about, active intelligence and lazy intelligence and active foolish and lazy foolish. And the worst is active foolish. So if you're foolish and you're still running around. So those are the things not to do if we want to be above the shades. And then the things to do, dedicate our work to Krishna. And at least once a week or once a day, but preferably at every moment. This is for you, this is for you, this is for you. There's a very easy way to do this, because we all know how to do this. Like, let's say I'm trying to impress her, and she's watching how I'm doing. So I'm being very nice to you, but let's just say I don't care about you, I care about her. I'm being nice to you so she'll be impressed. Have we all done that kind of thing? Yeah? Sometimes I think we do that with our bhakti. I'm going to sit, Hare Krishna, Hare... Are you watching? Do you see how I'm offering? So we all know this, right? Oh, should I say that? How when I was a young woman in a kirtan and I saw this sannyasi playing mridanga and he kept looking at the women the whole time. Anyway, he was a sannyasi for another like 3 days. But and I'm like, dude, you got a problem, dude. So we all know how to do this. You know, we all know how to do something for somebody, trying to please somebody else. All we have to do is have Krishna be the somebody else we're trying to please. How do I take care of my car? How do I take care of my phone? How do I take care of my body, my teeth, my hair? Krishna, are you watching? How do I deal with other people? Krishna, are you watching? Is he watching?
Yes.
What do we say? Krishna is the what? I am the
witness.
Are you watching? Are you watching? I am the sun and the moon. Prabhupada said, the mood of the residents of Vrindavan is I just want to make Krishna smile. So we can dedicate our work to Krishna periodically. That's a good start. And dedicating it to him at every moment is an incredibly joyful way to live. Absolutely incredible. Far above sattva. I think of sattva joy as like this big and bhakti joy as like, whoo! Keep an awareness of our spiritual self. What did Lord Chaitanya say? I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not a Kshatriya, I'm not a Vaishya, I'm not a Shudra, I'm not a Brahmacharya, I'm not a Grahastha, I'm not a Vanaprastha, I'm not a Sannyasi. What Jara Madhuri was saying, okay, you're not this body, but what body are you not? You know, we're really not these different roles that we take. We're not male or female, we're not old or young. We're not Lithuanian or French or Spanish or Polish or American. Thank God I'm not really an American. Sheesh. You know, we're not any of these things. And I'm working according to these things because that's what I have. That's the kind of vehicle I have. But that's not me. And to remember, it's not me. This is a role I'm taking for Krishna. I like to call this the secret agent principle. So if you become a secret agent and you're going to spy on North Korea, so you go to the immigration desk at the North Korean airport and you don't say, hi, I'm a spy. Right? You have a cover story. I'm an English teacher or I'm a computer salesman or something. All the work we do in this world is a cover story. We actually work for Krishna's company. And what's his product? What does he sell?
Bhakti.
What does he sell?
Prema.
love. Isn't that nice to work for the love company? We work for the love company. And then everybody we meet, either they're a supervisor in the love company, or they're a colleague, or they're a customer, or they're a potential customer. Maybe now they're shopping in the Illusion Mall, right? And everybody we're dealing with is like that. They're a supervisor, they're a colleague, they're a customer, or they're a potential customer. And our roles in this world are just our covers. That's all they are. Whatever field we work in, whatever family we're in, I'm this person's daughter, I'm this person's son, I'm this person's husband, I'm this person's wife, this person's brother or sister or mother or father, and I am a bank teller, and I am a guitar player, and I am a gardener, and I am a this, and I am a that. That's our cover story. And our real business is, how can I sell love of God here and now with the people and the circumstances that I'm in? And then we're above the shades of ego. And how interesting, that Krishna says if we want to work above the shades of ego, we have to work according to our nature. Isn't that interesting? If anybody tells you that the way to give up your ego is to do work that's not your work, just pull out Bhagavad Gita 3:30. 3.30. All right. We have finished all the career dharma principles for the individual, and now we're going to look at the system, and the person who asked me the systems question just walked out of the room. So these are the principles for the systems. So principle 8, maintaining societal balance, cooperation between the fields, and competition within the fields. So we're really looking at three things: balance, cooperation, competition. This is how the people in the fields interact with each other. Now, we also had some people ask, I think it was you. We also had some people ask, how do we follow this if society isn't following it? You know, do we need a perfect society? So the answer is, all the seven things we talked about up till now, you can do that even if society is a mess. Isn't that nice? 7 of the 9, you can do even if society is a mess. And this is how to make society not a mess. All right, so cooperation. How do the fields cooperate? People and ideas, they train and guide others. People in government, they approve licensing. They approve accreditation. They may provide venues. They may provide facilitators to help launch and repair and maintain cooperative endeavors. Then resources, they organize, direct, and distribute the flow of money, materials, and energy. And artistry helps the other fields. They're the assistants. They make everything work. And in this way, the people in the four fields all cooperate with each other. You know, these fields are compared to parts of the body, right? Your stomach cooperates with your brain, that cooperates with your heart, that cooperates with your limbs, yes? In order to have us functioning. Now, we talked about a little earlier cherishing our prosperity type and cherishing our field of wealth. So the idea is that each person will cherish and nourish and preserve the integrity of their own field. Kind of like we expect that everyone keeps their own room clean. But that doesn't always happen. People don't always keep the integrity in their own field. So there has to be some way. There has to be some way for checks and balances. So the people in the different field, they also keep the other fields honest. So people in the field of ideas, they especially keep the government honest. Think about the role of the free press. The main thing that a free press is supposed to do is to keep the government honest. Well, why doesn't it work these days? Because you have people in the wrong field. And because you have people not cherishing their field. We talk about how the line between journalism and advertising has become blurred. Yeah? Okay. But that's what the field of ideas is supposed to do. How does the government keep everybody honest through the law? How does resources keep everyone honest? What they spend their money on? Yeah? What they spend money on. I don't like your policies, I'm not going to give you money. Now, it's interesting with artistry. Artistry keeps the other fields honest, first of all, because there's more people in artistry than in other fields. So what they kind of, the effect they have as a group. But there's another way as well, and this really came to my attention recently in some court cases in the United States. What do people write songs about? What do they make movies about? What do they draw paintings about? What kind of movies and TV shows and theater? The people in artistry translate concepts from ideas and government and resources to people in general. And they can choose what they're going to translate and what they're not. If people in artistry say, I don't agree with this thing from the government, and therefore I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to put it in my art. Yeah? All right, let's go to competition. Now, a lot of people in 2023 think competition is a bad thing. Srila Prabhupada said that competition gives life. Now, you might say that, well, we should do our best for its own sake. But in practice, it doesn't work like that. When we have an opponent, we become energized. Our mind gets focused. Our efforts get invigorated. We get inspired. We're reminded of our own potential. We're more likely to explore the edge of our abilities. There's competition in the spiritual world, folks. They're having a competition. Who's going to touch Krishna first? The gopis are competing. Who's going to please Krishna the best? And there's different groups, and they have different ways of pleasing Krishna that they're competing for. Now, competition should not be envious or hurtful. It shouldn't be predatory. We shouldn't be trying to erase other people or dominate other people. It should be more like there's a jewelry district or a fashion district, and there's a whole lot of fashion stores in the same place. And by that competition, each of them does better. So competition in the field of artistry, it's led to great inventions, to classic masterpieces of art and music, higher quality of craft work. Competition in resources is one of the reasons that most of the people on this planet are being fed, that things are being distributed well. Efficient and effective ways of distribution of supplies. Competition between firms. It's led great innovation in technology, in information systems, and in things that make our life easier. Competition in government. We can think about how in most countries there's more than one political party, and they compete with each other, at least theoretically, for the benefit of the country. And there's also different types of political systems that compete. Yeah, and people can see, well, do I want a socialist government or a communist government or a socialist democracy or a parliamentary democracy or a direct democracy? And there can be different types of experimentation with government. And different governments win, isn't it? The people decide I'd rather have that kind of government. And competition in government also provides for better services for the people. Like who's going to provide the best mass transit, and who's going to provide the best health care, and who's going to provide the best sanitation, because there's a sense of competition. Competition in the field of ideas helps. It's one of the main ways that religion gets purified. If people are leaving your religious organization and going to other people's religion, then you have to see, wait a minute, what's wrong with what I'm doing? Maybe I need to change something. Maybe I need to purify something. The same with philosophy. It weeds out bad ideas or harmful ideas. And our last one, on a societal level, is all-inclusive, sustainable prosperity. So modern economists made a deliberate, intentional decision that they would separate economic theory from land ownership. They would say economic prosperity has nothing to do with the land. Now, what's wrong with that? It's not reality. All wealth ultimately comes from nature. Yeah? It all ultimately comes from nature. And modern economists, for quite some decades now, have propounded, there was an intentional decision, let's separate economics from the land. And so then the economists propound a system of unlimited economic growth. Is that possible? We cannot have infinite economic growth on a finite planet. It just doesn't work. And so when they propound this, right, we have all these countries borrowing more and more money. Have you noticed this? They're just borrowing more and more and more and more money so their economic growth can go up and up and up. What's happening? There's a huge wealth disparity in the world. We have, you know, people who are very rich and people who are extremely poor. And we have a huge amount of exploitation going on in the world. You know, a lot of the ways that people are enjoying prosperity are at the expense of somebody who's being exploited, often in another part of the world where you can't see it. That's not a sustainable system. And it certainly isn't a dharmic system. And this is another reason I see why Prabhupada very much linked Varnashram to simple living, to ways of living that could provide all-inclusive, sustainable prosperity. All right. So we've looked at identifying our ideal career field and prosperity type, learning the secrets of making our life deeply meaningful, progressing toward dharmic mastery, and the whole system for peace and prosperity. So we have some time. If we have any, this is my last class here, and I probably won't be coming here I'll be here the next 2 days, but I don't know if I'm coming here. So if there's anything else that anybody would like to discuss on any of these points. Yes.
Before we spoke that when you do charity, it should be done without expecting anything in return.
Correct.
That's charity in the mode of goodness or charity?
Well, it's a charity in the mode of goodness, but in the mode of goodness, and I'd rather use sattvagun. Charity in sattvagun, you're not expecting anything external in return. You are definitely expecting something internal in return. You're expecting a sense of satisfaction with yourself. In Rajas, you may expect other people to praise you. You have a plaque up in the hallway. What a big charity giver. There's a dinner in your honor. You know, you're listed as one of the most charitable people in the world. Or you may even be expecting that you're going to get a favor in return. I helped you out when you needed it, now I need you to help me out when I need it. A kind of merchant thing. So in sattva, you're not doing that. In sattva, you give and you give. But you are expecting that, that's fine. You are expecting this inner set, I give just to give. I give because it makes me feel happy. The motive in sattva is that sense of inner harmony and inner balance and inner peace and inner detachment. That's what motivates a person in sattva. What?
Virtue signaling or not?
Virtue signaling is probably mostly in Rajas, but I'm sure it also happens in sattva. But it's mostly in Rajas. I'm doing this because I'm good. Because in Rajas, you're looking for external validation of your goodness. In sattva, you're looking for an internal validation of your goodness. People in Rajas are actually very out of touch with an inner joy. You know, in Tamas, Krishna says you're not really getting any kind of happiness at all. I mean, you're getting some egoistic sense that I'm better than everyone else because I don't work so hard. And I'm better than everyone else because I take the easiest, fastest way of getting what I want. And I'm better than everyone else because I don't care about the consequences of my actions. I'm not so overwhelmed with guilt and, you know. In Rajas, you think you're better than everyone else because you follow everything perfectly, but you want everyone to notice that. And there's a inner agitation in Rajas. I have to work harder and harder and harder. And in Rajas, you're taking a lot of pride in your hard work. In both Rajas and in Tamas, your enjoyments are mostly sensory. What pleasures you get through your gross senses. In Rajas, you have a little bit more of the mind, but it's more like, wow, see how everybody is appreciating me. And in Sattva, it's almost all, you know, that I'm in balance and I'm in harmony. Kind of thing. I'm a good person. Krishna says in Sattva, you're conditioned by happiness and knowledge. If there's any material happiness, it's in Sattva. Much more so than in Rajas. In Rajas, it's, you know, the pleasure of eating a good pizza kind of thing. But that's not really joy. You follow? You know? Whereas in Sattva, it's actually you're getting some joy. Why are you getting some joy in Sattva? Because you are working in harmony with Krishna, although you're doing it for your own pleasure. And the reason there's more harmony in Rajas is you're working more in harmony with Krishna than the poor fellows in Tamas, who only work in harmony by accident. They happen to, like a broken clock is right twice a day, so every once in a while they do something that's in harmony. Yes? No, go ahead.
If you feel that we are, I think, under Rajas, I mean, when we try to search external validation, shall we suppress this feeling instead of and go to...
What do you think? Yeah, I think we should not. First of all, I don't think you're going to win over Rajas in a head-to-head battle. I mean, Lord Brahma controls Rajas, and I just don't think you're going to... I don't think it's going to work. I really don't think you're going to work. Yeah, he's got three more heads than you. And, like, I don't think you're going to win over Tamas in a head-to-head battle. He's got a trident and, you know... I don't think it's going to work. So, what does Krishna say in 14:22-25? One of my all-time favorite verses. One who does not hate illumination, which is sattva, attachment, which is rajas, and delusion, which is tamas, when they appear. One who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear. One who does not hate illumination, attachment, or delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear, knowing that the modes alone are active and always remaining neutral. So, you know, I've been trying for years to find a good English name for Mr. Sattva. But, you know, we've got Mr. Roger and Mr. Thomas. So it's like, oh, there's Mr. Thomas. It's like some grouchy neighbor, you know. It's like, oh, there's Mr. Thomas. You know grouchy people, right? We all know Thomas people. Yeah, everybody knows some Thomas people?
Yes.
There's Mr. Thomas. Ah, come on. There's Mr. Thomas. And it doesn't matter whether he's walking through your external space or through your mind. Hi, Thomas. I know you. You're one of Krishna's energies. You're not mine. You're not mine. You're not me. We want to recognize them. Even Sattva. Oh, I see you. I know you with your crystals and angels. No, I don't think I really want my next life with the rishis on the higher planets. It's all right. I'll let them do what they're going to do. You know, just... It's not me. Not me. careful we don't pull energy from them. It's tempting. They'll go, don't you need some of my energy right now? You could use it, couldn't you? Look at this work you're doing. I would be very helpful to you. Like, nah, it's all right. I'll go to the source, that's okay. I'll get my energy there. Clean energy. I'll get clean energy, thank you very much. Not going to pollute myself with your energies. Even sattva's polluting. In fact, sattva can be the most polluting because you think you're already spiritual. You ever tried to preach to sattva people about Krishna? It can be really hard. They'll chant with you, they'll take prasadam, and you say, would you like to dedicate your life to Krishna? I'm already spiritual. Sure, I respect you, Hare Krishnas. You're great. You're wonderful. I'll come to your kirtans. But I'm not going to come in. I'm already spiritual. Whereas the Rajas people will go, man, I'm tired of working so hard. I'm working this hard for this much benefit, and you know, is there another way? And the Tamas people are like, oh man, I'm really suffering. Whereas the Sattva people are like, I'm happy. It can be just as much of a problem. Chaitanya Swami once said, Sattva is like the airport, but it's not the airplane. But you know, airports can be kind of cool places sometimes. We'll just hang out in the airport. But anyway, yeah, it's detachment. And then we talked about yesterday. I think it was yesterday? Yeah? Finding a rich inner life. Was that yesterday? I've been talking so much here, I can't remember what the day it was. But I think it was yesterday. Was it? When we were talking about Rohini? I think that was yesterday.
Yesterday.
It was yesterday. In the morning. Yeah. Yeah, and it was your question, right? Did I get the right person who asked the question about being detached?
Yes.
And Rasa, was that you?
Yes.
I think it was him. Yes, okay. So we have something better than the voidists and the impersonalists. They're just detached. The voidists and the impersonalists, most of them, mostly, are in sattva. They're still shaded. And some of them, sometimes, go to Brahmabhuta. Sometimes. But even then, they get bored. But we can have a rich emotional life in bhakti. Everything we're looking for in sattva, rajas, and tamas exists in a perfect state in Krishna. We can get it from there. It's like getting the real juice instead of the chemical juice. Whereas the voidists and the impersonalists, they don't have real juice. So to train ourselves to do that, a very, very easy way to do that is like all the Krishna meditation stuff I was teaching. How can I find Krishna? I can find him in the heat in this room, in the light of the sun, in the sounds of ether, in my ability to sit. How can I find Krishna right now? Maybe I can't meditate. Maybe I'm, you know, at work in the bank and there's no picture of Krishna and the cowherd boys to meditate on. But I can still meditate on Krishna as my intelligence, my ability. Wow, I gave that person the right, whatever. And I can feel his presence wherever I am. And then I can do this for him. He's the light of the sun that's in my room. I can do this for his pleasure. Let's try this right now. You're sitting here. Why are you sitting here? Can you sit here for his pleasure? Can you listen to this? Can you learn this for his pleasure? Can you feel him? I don't mean this in a bad way, but forget the deities are here. I don't mean that in a bad way, but let's pretend we're not in a room with deities and pictures. Okay? Can we be aware of Krishna as the light of the sun? This room is being filled with the light of the sun. Can you now, in this moment, dedicate your sitting here and learning this to Krishna as present in the light of the sun? Can you do that? How do you feel? How do you feel? Is that cool? Is that cool? Can you feel it? I want you to try to feel it. I don't want you to do this in your head as a philosophical thing. I want you to try to feel it. Feel Krishna in the light of the sun in this room. or in the heat of the room, or in your ability, feel him. I'm doing this for you. I'm learning this for you. I'm trying to understand this for you. I'm thinking of how I can apply this for you. You who are my ability to sit. You who are the warmth in my body. You who are the light in this room. I'm doing it for you. Can you feel it? How does it feel? You should have at least touched sattva. At least you should have touched sattva. Like that. Did you feel something? Yes? No? Not you, him. He asked the question. Did you feel something? Yes.
Yeah, that looks pretty good.
Well, there you go. That's it. So you see Mr. Roger coming. Hey, Roger. Recognize him. It's not me. It's Roger. My mind and body start going, Roger, 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 Roger. And it's like, ah, that's Roger. All right, where's Krishna? Hi, Roger. Where's Krishna? If you're not by the deities, you're not by a picture, you're not by the words, where's Krishna? He's in my ability. He's in my breath. He's in the trees. He's in the birds. He's in the air. I'm going to do this for you. And then you forget that Roger was even there. He just, all the, you know, as well, he's gone. How is it? Okay? Will you do this perfectly all the time? No, I don't do this perfectly all the time. But what happens is, you know, we have big jumps. Some big realization. And then we have some dips. Uh-oh. I just got taken over by Thomas. Sheesh. All right. Uh-oh, just got taken over by sattva. Oh my God, I can't believe I got taken over by sattva. How ridiculous is that? Okay, Krishna, where are you? All right. That's how it goes. And gradually, it becomes more of your way of being. And gradually, you'll only be overcome when the modes are really heavy or you're in a particularly weakened state. You weren't careful with what you eat, you weren't careful with who you hung out with, you weren't so careful with your japa, you weren't so careful with your reading, you're sick, you're tired, you just had a catastrophe in your life, and you're weak. And then, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is awful. But after a while, that will only happen more and more rarely and more in difficult situations. And you become gradually more and more and more and more steady. There'll be some blips and blip and blip and jump and jump. And don't give up. Don't say, oh, I was doing so great and then I got... And this is, I can't believe I yelled at that person. Why did I do that? I was doing great for the last year. You know, that'll happen. Be kind to yourself. Then you can say, oh yeah, I got a human body and I'm in Kali Yuga. I'm actually doing pretty well. Okay? All right? Anything else? Yes?
Changing topic, you mentioned women and how the ideal traditional job for women would be to work cooperatively with their husbands. So my question is, what if the couple has two different fields? Could they clash or could they cooperate?
Oh, very nice question. So generally you see in the scripture, husbands and wife having two different fields is strongly discouraged. In fact, the main discussion you'll find of women's fields of work in the Shastra is in relation to marriage and making sure that the husband and wife have the same field. If there is a different field, then, and I have avoided using words higher and lower, very intentionally, but the husband should be in a higher field. But even that's very discouraged. There's the anulom and the pratilom. It's interesting when you have situations in the Bhagavatam of husband and wife in two different fields. If the children take after a parent, it's usually the mother. Like Rama Harshan Sutta, his mother was in ideas, his father was in government, and he took after his mother. And someone like Vidura, that's kind of a funny case. He's considered technically in government because, you know, his father was technically Vichitravirya, but actually it was Vyasadeva who's in ideas, and then his mother is in artistry. But he's identified as being in artistry, although he actually worked in government. Like when Duryodhan threw him out, he put down his bow and it said now he wouldn't fight anymore. So, ah! So what do you do if husband and wife are in different fields? Learn to appreciate each other and don't try to make the other person like you. You know, I hope that part of this has been to learn to appreciate the Dharma and the values of people in other fields. You know, we started out in the second day when we defined the fields, asking about the prejudices we have about people in the fields. So it's very easy to be in my own space and my own mentality and think anyone who's not like me is bad. So come to appreciate that everybody in every field has something glorious to do. And I know some wonderful marriages where people are in different fields. I know one marriage where the husband is in ideas, woman is in resources. And they're a wonderfully loving couple and they're very cooperative. And she basically funds his stuff. You know, I know of a couple where the husband is in government and the wife is in artistry. And she just tries to appreciate his stuff that she can't, she's not really like into it. But she just tries to appreciate it. And I mean, that can work a little better because she can be like in the mood of assisting. You know, but even then, I mean, the kind of thing that she's into, he's not into it at all. They're just not into the same things. I mean, they're into the same things in terms of Krishna consciousness. But they just appreciate what each other is into. They're just appreciative of each other's values. And I mean, there are sometimes it's hard, but there's sometimes it's hard no matter what. You know, welcome to the world. I don't care how much you love someone and how much you're similar to them, there's going to be conflict sometimes with anybody. But it's mostly appreciating. I mean, a similar but very different thing is there in cross-cultural marriages. Cross-cultural marriages are huge challenges. And they only work if you separate the person's character from their culture. You don't judge their character by cultural behaviors. And if you learn to appreciate aspects of their culture. Like I have a friend who's French-American. She married a South Indian. And like a week into the marriage, he's like, my wife is so rude. I said, no, she's not actually. She's just French-American. Yes. So to be able to do that, to be able to see, I mean, it's anyway, that's a similar thing. I've studied a lot about cultural differences. There's a huge difference between, you know, Sweden and Germany. I mean, it's huge. So it's just separating that. That the way this person behaves, it doesn't mean there's, even though it may look bad to me, is it really that they're just acting properly according to their field? Otherwise, it's the same thing with the adults who criticize the children. Oh, why are you thinking so much? Or why are you being so bossy? Or why do you just think about making money? Why are you always drawing pictures? I mean, I'm thinking of one couple I know where, you know, the wife was always on the husband's case, why aren't you more ambitious to earn more money? And he was never going to be more ambitious to earn more money. It wasn't his dharma. And she was constantly nagging him like this. Why can't you be more ambitious? Why can't he? He's never going to be more ambitious. It's not how he's wired. So to be able to just accept that. You know. I mean, this is also true in terms of prosperity type. I mean, one piece of advice I give couples in general is what Krishna says to Rukmini. You should have marriages between people who are equal in renunciation. I see this as like really top of the top of the top thing. Your level of love for Vairagya should be the same. You really don't want somebody who wants a house full of furniture and, you know, fancy cars with somebody who wants to sleep on the floor. It doesn't work very well. And I think this problem is compounded when you're Hare Krishnas, because the one who's more interested in Vairagya can seem so much more spiritual. You know, the person who's less into Vairagya will say, oh, you know, you don't care about anything. You're just hard-hearted. And the person who's more into Vairagya will say, oh, you're more just a materialist and you just want sense gratification. So please try to have equality in Vairagya as far as you can. Especially in that one. Otherwise, it's really difficult. And if somehow you're already in a marriage where you have widely disparate needs in terms of Vairagya, then it's again a question of respecting the other person and not trying to impose your view on them. This is also something I say to, like, especially to men who say, well, I'd like to marry, but I'm really into renunciation. And I said, then find a woman who's really into renunciation. I said, they're out there. I said, there's women out there who really like renunciation and will be just absolutely thrilled to have a husband who feels the same way. Is that all right? I mean, in general, in society, we want to respect each other's differences. And then find what areas of compatibility there are. There's always something that's compatible. There's always something where you can agree on and something where you can be in sync. Especially as devotees, we can be in sync in terms of Krishna consciousness. That makes things a whole lot easier. You know, if our mode of working in the world is very different, at least we can all love Krishna and all dedicate our work to Krishna. But anyway, I see these work when there's a high level of respect and a high level of trying to be appreciative of the strength and the glory of another person that's radically different from yours. Yes?
You know how in astrology they say that you're born in this and that garden, let's say, according to birth chart, then, like, how does this apply to what you're doing?
Okay, thank you for asking about astrology. By the way, I'm going to end in 10 minutes. I definitely believe that astrology is a bona fide science. Astrology, palmistry are bona fide sciences. I haven't found very many people who are expert in those sciences nowadays. I just haven't, and I have a lot of good friends who are astrologers, and most of them will tell you they're not that expert. So I always like the story of Sanatan Goswami. You know the story of Sanatan Goswami with the 8 gold coins? So Sanatan was running away, and he was going through the back roads with his servant, and his servant had kept 8 gold coins that Sanatan didn't know about. So they stopped at a hotel, and the hotel keeper had a servant or an assistant, or someone who was expert at reading palms. And he said to the manager of the hotel, this man has 8 gold coins. So the manager of the hotel thought, oh, this guy's rich. And he started being super nice to Sanatan Goswami. Sanatan Goswami had worked in government his whole life, and he understood diplomacy. So he thought, this guy's being way too nice. He wants something. So he went to his servant. He said, do you have any money? And his servant said, I have 7 gold coins. So Sanatan took the 7 gold coins and he gave them to the head of the inn. And he said, this is a burden for me. You can have it. And the innkeeper said, I knew you had 8 gold coins and I was going to kill you for them and take them. But now that you've voluntarily given me 7 of them, I will help you. Then Sanatan went to his servant. He said, do you still have anything else? He said, yes, I have 1 more. He said, take it, go home. All right, there's a lot of lessons there. But in this regard, how did the assistant to the innkeeper know that Sanatan Goswami had 8 gold coins by looking at his palm? Have any of you ever had your palm read? Okay, when someone reads your palm, they take your hand, they take each hand separately, and they spread out your palm and they really look at the lines in your hand. And sometimes they'll look at your hand for a half an hour. And they'll look at each of your hands. They're looking at it like this and they're spreading it out. And they're looking like that. Do you think Sanatan Goswami did that with the innkeeper's assistant? No. How much of a look at Sanatan's hands did this guy get? And he knew how many gold coins Sanatan Goswami has. If you find an astrologer like that, they can tell you what your work is. Good luck. What I see what most astrologers do is they look at certain things in isolation. And there's, I hope I'm not going to bore any of you. So you know there's, everyone knows there's like Aries and Taurus and Pisces, there's the signs. So in addition to the signs is what's called the nakshatras. The nakshatras are 27 constellations. And sort of, kind of, ish, sort of, little bit, you could say, sort of, that the nakshatras are further divisions of the signs. Okay, there's 12 signs, there's 27 nakshatras, so each sign is divided into like two or two and a half nakshatras. And they particularly look at the rising sign. Rising sign is where the sun is on the horizon when you were born. So your sun is in a particular sign, and then it's also in a nakshatra. Then your moon is in a sign, and your moon is in the nakshatra. So the sun is being the main indicator of yourself, and the moon is being the main indicator of your mentality. So they'll look at the what nakshatra the moon is in. And this is when astrologers look at super simple marriage compatibility, when they give you a number of points, they're only looking at comparing the moon's nakshatras. They're not looking at anything else. And this is what we call kutas. And each of these refer to something, and one of them refers to Varna. Do you think anybody could tell you what your career is by looking at one teeny tiny aspect of your personality? I don't think so. So, I mean, to really understand your career from your chart, you'd have to look at all of the placements of the planets by sign, nakshatra, and house. Then you'd have to look at how they relate to each other. Very few astrologers do this. If they do this, they'll probably charge you $400. And even then, they won't be very good at it. It's extremely rare that they're very good at it. So when someone says, this is your Varna from your chart, 99 times out of 100, they are looking at one of the kutas of the moon's nakshatras. The value of this is somewhere, I'd say it's negative. I'd say it has negative value. You would learn much, 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 much more about your career from a combination of introspection based on what we've studied from the Shastra and consulting with people who know you well than you would from somebody who's not very skilled looking at your chart. And they're probably going to look at things in isolation. Now, I've had astrologers tell me very useful things. I'm not saying it's all rubbish. But for this thing, it doesn't... I just haven't met very many that are that good. I tried.
My question was more like how they explain... So if you're according to...
I explain it because they don't know what they're doing.
No, like for a person is born artistry, but then his life or her...
But they're not born into it because they don't know what they're doing. They're telling you this is what you're born into, but they don't know. They don't know how to read it. It's like, okay, I studied Sanskrit for a few years. I can read the Devanagari very slowly with a lot of hesitation. I know quite a bit of Sanskrit vocabulary just from having read Prabhupada's books and gone to Bhagavatam classes for 50 years. I know some Sanskrit grammar. Believe me, if I try to translate verses on my own, I'm going to give you the wrong translation. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. I personally know something of astrology. I know just enough to be dangerous. Okay, I know something of palmistry. I remember one devotee came to me that a palmist told her that her child would die very young, like when he was born, which by the way is something that palmists and astrologers are never supposed to do. It's against their dharma to do that kind of thing. Anyway, that, and she was in so much anxiety. He was 3 years old. So I also know something about palmistry. I said, show me your son's hand. He had this clear, deep lifeline. It's like, I said, whoever told you this is nuts. I said, he has one of the clearest, deepest, longest lifelines I've ever seen. And he doesn't even have any health line, and there's no accident crossing lines. But I read about this palmist, I don't think he's alive anymore, but he could tell people details of life. I mean, he could say to people, when you are 33, you're going to be in an accident and break your leg. You know, again, good luck. It's just, what about medicine? In the Bhagavatam, there were people who could change males into females, and they really did it. They actually did it, you know. The whole story of Ila and Sujumna. Ila was born a female, and that turned into a male by Vasistha. Then he got turned into a female by Lord Shiva. Then he married Buddha and had three children. She married Buddha and had three children. And then she complained again to Vasistha, or her father complained. And then Vasistha worked out a deal with Lord Shiva so that she could become a man every other month and a woman every other month. And then as a man, he got married and produced children. Can the doctors do that? No. They're trying. So these things are possible, but people today don't know how to do them. It's not that they're not possible. Even the doctors are like, maybe you have this wrong with you, maybe you have this, maybe you have that. And 5 years later they find out, oh, actually you had this. And actually the medicines we gave you for what we thought you had were making you sicker. So, you know, like that. You know, astrology is useful, palmistry is useful, personality tests are useful. Those are all useful. But please, the biggest thing I'd say is good introspection and good guidance. I would really put that above all these other things. And a lot of the personality tests are very, very, very useful, but not as useful. Okay? Is that all right? All right, well, I hope that you have found something useful in all this. And as I've said each time, whatever good here is from Prabhupada, whatever bad here is mine. I hope you can take the good and ignore the bad.